Hello, welcome to another Brewing podcast. We have had a number of podcasts on all things economic and China and really capturing the important factors at the moment. But there's one topic we have steered clear of, and it's the biggest topic in the news at the moment. Of course, the coronavirus, and we will be discussing its impact on the global economy with none other than Joachim Fels, the chief economist of PIMCO, the world's largest fixed income investment manager. We'll find out from him what the biggest risks in the financial community are.
You know, there's a kind of vicious circle developing between, you know, saving and interest rates and lower interest rates or even negative interest rates.
And so to get a bit more detail on that, please make sure you stay tuned after the following important messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Okay, hello everybody, welcome to another Brewin podcast. I'm delighted to be joined on this occasion by the chief economist of PIMCO, Joachim Fels. Joachim, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome to the Brewin podcast.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
This is obviously a really interesting time for the global economy because I guess the new year has started and everybody had their outlooks for 2020 prepared, and then this sort of big shock that probably wasn't in many people's outlooks when they were writing them in 2019 has occurred, the coronavirus.
Right.
So are you able to update how you're feeling about the global economy in light of what is obviously an extremely fluid and changing position?
Well, as you say, it's extremely fluid. It is actually something we've been discussing in the last few days, and we continue those discussions in our investment committee in Newport Beach. Generally, I think this is one of the proverbial black swans that keep hitting. You know, you never know exactly when. It's impossible to forecast. And this one is, I think, the coronavirus is particularly difficult because, you know, we don't have a lot of historical evidence. I mean, we have the SARS episode in early 2000, 2002, 2003. But that's almost 20 years in the past. China's importance in the global economy has risen a lot. There's a lot more Chinese people traveling.
Because if you look at the SARS epidemic on a chart, obviously it would make us all feel very relaxed about this situation.
Correct. But the problem is, and I guess the baseline assumption and our baseline assumption is that this is similar to SARS, something that will blow over eventually.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're having a risk-off move in markets at the moment. This is likely to affect economic activity in China and probably also global trade and travel for some time. But it's not a fundamental change. I don't think it fundamentally changes the outlook.
Yeah.
Having said that, I mean, we have to consider much more adverse scenarios, obviously. Nobody knows how this really will develop. But for now, we're just watching. We have not made any major changes in our portfolios for the time being. And, you know, this is just another of those disruptions to the global economy, to financial markets, to portfolios that we have been, in a way, anticipating in a very general sense, in a very generic sense, in our secular outlook last year. It was entitled Dealing with Disruption. We were not thinking of coronavirus, obviously, but other disruptions coming from economic policy, coming from geopolitics. But this is one of the things that, you know, investors should keep in mind. There will be episodes when you have these risk-off moves, And it does make sense to have some insurance against these moves in portfolios.
Yeah, a lot of these things tend to be kind of invisible in the sort of headline indices, but quite noticeable when you get down to particular regions or particular sectors. So I guess most notably when SARS struck, from an equity perspective, which I know is not the perspective perhaps that you would take, but from an equity perspective, it's really obviously hit luxury goods really hard.
Right.
And China's more important now to luxury goods than it had been then. I mean, I guess what we know about this coronavirus outbreak is that it is, to state the obvious, very much centered in China. So the indicators that we've heard of seem to suggest there's quite a material reduction in activity, things like travel and spending, just based on even the holiday season last year. So, I mean, would you agree that we're going to see a hit to growth or a hit to activity, at least in China?
Yeah, almost certainly. So it's centered on China at the moment, as you've mentioned. It affects sectors like travel. It affects, you know, tourism. It affects the retail sector.
Yeah.
But the longer this lasts, the more the virus spreads. I think we should also anticipate more a hit to production, because production facilities in China may be hit. This could affect the global supply chain. So I think there could be a spreading of this event to global trade.
Right.
Right. And let's not forget that China these days is the key driver of the global business cycle, given, you know, its importance for the global supply chain. And so I think those impacts would be felt here in Europe as well, because Europe is very closely linked into the global trade cycle. Now, again, it's early days, but I think these are some of the things we need to keep in the back of our minds, especially as in the last few months, there were some, you know, initial signs of a rebound in global growth, like in the PMIs. And obviously, markets had rallied a lot in anticipation of a recovery in global growth this year. And there is now, that it's still our baseline that happens, but there is now some question mark over that outlook. And I think markets need to price that in, which I think explains this risk-off move and the rally in duration that we've been seeing.
And so because activity was a bit weak last year globally, but particularly in places like Europe and China, and I guess even within Europe, particularly in Germany, does the coronavirus outcome place more pressure on things like the German economy, particularly, or the European economy?
I think it could, because due to the weakness that you've mentioned, that we've seen in economic activity, particularly in the industrial sector in places like Germany, you could argue that sector is now more vulnerable to additional shocks. So corporates have seen their sales falling, right? They've cut production. But if you see an additional shock, so if the coronavirus, you know, spreads further, if this is starting to affect production in China and Chinese imports more materially, then you could argue that this would be a reason for corporates, for companies, to hold back further on investment spending and also to hold back on hiring, which is how this could then spread to the consumer sector, to the domestic economy, which has still been doing reasonably well in Europe so far.
So, I mean, you mentioned that it could disrupt the supply chain. I guess that means it could start to have a bit of a supply side constricting effect.
Right.
Whereas the bond market clearly sees this as more of a sort of demand side restricting event. Bond yields have fallen, implying that it makes the outlook look less inflationary. Is there a way that this could be a more inflationary outcome, do you think?
Well, I think in general or in theory, a shock like this is likely to be stagflationary initially.
Right, okay.
Because, yes, it affects demand negatively, but also supply. There may be some shortages developing in parts of the supply chain, so it could put upward pressure on producer input prices. But I think medium and longer term, such a shock is more likely to be disinflationary. So you get the short-term inflationary impulse, but that's more like a one-off upward shock to prices, and then the weakness in activity that, you know, comes along with this shock is likely to depress inflation further out.
So if in the scenario in which this is severe enough to prompt central banks to react to it, you would expect them to be reacting from a dovish perspective, trying to support that potentially diminished longer-term growth outlook or demand outlook, and looking through the shorter-term potential impact on prices.
Definitely. I mean, even before this shock, even before this coronavirus hit, you know, our view was that the hurdle to further monetary easing is much lower than the hurdle to rate hikes. So put differently, central banks have been pretty dovish all along. They became more dovish last year. The Fed, the ECB are engaged in an internal review of their own monetary policy strategy. And part of the likely outcome is going to be that they will try to re-anchor inflation expectations higher, closer to the target, which means they'd be more willing to overshoot the target on inflation for a while without reacting by hiking interest rates. So I think there's there has been a further dovish shift by central banks, which, you know, has been a trend for the last 10, 12 years, but we've seen another dovish shift last year. And you know, this latest shock, I think, increases the probability that we will see further easing in the course of this year. Again, not our baseline view yet, but
no,
I think the probability is clearly rising, and I think this is what the bond market is trying to price in. And I think it also argues that, you know, beyond the initial shock, beyond the initial impact on the flattening of the yield curve that we've seen, the long end has rallied more than the short end, which is typical during this risk-off moves. But medium term, I think this more dovish posture will lead to more of a steepening of the yield curve over time.
So really good of you to mention the strategic reviews that are going on at the Fed and the ECB. What do you think is driving that sort of soul searching right at this moment? Because I guess inflation has held low for quite some time, but now you've got these two banks actually looking, or two institutions looking at it at the same time.
Yeah, I like your soul-searching expression. Maybe we should call these not strategic reviews, but strategic soul-searching. So what's behind this? I think two things. First of all, the Fed and the ECB have been missing their inflation targets for a long time now, right? The Fed, when Ben Bernanke, who chairs our Global Advisory Board, when he was at the helm at the Fed and introduced the 2% inflation target in January 2012, that was about the last time that inflation was at 2%. And ever since,
right. They've
been running below. And the ECB has been missing its target by an even wider margin. So that's reason for soul searching, right? For reviewing reasons why this might be the case, you know, for reviewing whether anything can be changed in the strategy or in the communication to get inflation closer to target. That's one motivation. The other motivation for the review is that they're simply running out of tools. They're running out of ammunition. They've done all these things over the last 10, 12 years, QE, negative interest rates in Europe. The ECB is not only buying public sector assets, it's buying private sector assets. So obviously with rates already negative in Europe, with balance sheets, central bank balance sheets bloated due to all these asset purchases, they just have to think through what else they could do. Because if you're a central bank, you will never say, or you never want to get into a situation where you say, well, we're done, right? There's nothing else we can do. You always want to be able to at least pretend that you have more tools at your disposal.
Although at the same time, you also want to try and push the fiscal authorities to try and carry a bit of the burden themselves as well. So it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. I mean, ideally, you know, if in an ideal world, fiscal policy would have done much more of the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And that would have left central banks with more ammunition, you know, to play the fire brigade when something goes really wrong. But unfortunately, I mean, so far we've seen that fiscal policy either doesn't react, or it reacts too late, or it reacts in the wrong direction. We've seen all these things happening in different places over the last 10 years. So if you're a central bank or a central banker, you will obviously push governments and fiscal authorities to do more, to become more reactive, or more proactive. but there's no guarantee that that will happen, because in the end, fiscal policy is always due to a political process. And so things can change with the next election here or there. You can never rely on that. So you better, you know, have a good idea as a central banker. You better try to figure out what else you can do in that next downturn, be it buying equities here in Europe, which is something the ECB could theoretically do, or adapting yield curve targeting, which is something the Fed is discussing. The Fed will certainly also consider whether they could go negative on rates. We think it's unlikely they will, but it's something they will discuss. So, you know, it's just about, as you said, soul searching, but also preparing for that next downturn.
And so things like negative interest rates, buying equities, would seem very radical. Is it 10 years ago? Maybe a bit more than 10 years ago now. But I guess they've been tried in various places now. Would you think that the results indicate that they're that they're likely to be successful policies?
Well, on negative rates, I think the jury is out, because you know, there are some positive effects, because negative rates help to incentivize banks to try to get rid of these excess reserves on which banks are now being taxed. That may amplify the effects of QE. So it provides an additional incentive for banks to move out the risk curve to try to get rid of these excess reserves by buying assets and thus bidding up the prices of those assets and pushing down yields and pushing down risk premiums. But as we all know, over time, negative rates have negative side effects, particularly for the financial sector, you know, for savers, for pension funds, insurance companies, for the banks themselves. So I think in future, central banks will probably be a little bit more reluctant to push rates negative. And I think the experience that the ECB and others have made also makes the Bank of England, the Fed, less likely to try to adopt that tool in the future. So they have to think about other things. And I think we're talking about forward guidance, maybe yield curve control, and even more asset purchases.
As you've got, because of demographic changes, you've got more people approaching retirement now than in previous years. And a lot of those consumers will be becoming more sensitive to the kind of income they're going to expect in retirement. So, I mean, is it totally naive to think, well, perhaps these low rates are actually forcing people to save a lot harder than they would have done if actually rates had been higher? And, like, could that be a counterproductive feature of the overall policy or the overall assumption? For many decades, obviously, it was correct. Lower interest rates implies less saving, more spending. But because of the demographics, could that not be the case now?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, there's a kind of vicious circle developing between, you know, saving and interest rates and lower interest rates or even negative interest rates, forcing people to save even more, particularly if they have certain target wealth that they want to achieve before they retire. But I think we should not fully blame central banks for this. Because I think one reason why interest rates are so low, why market rates are so low, is that there is a need to save more for old age. People realize that. So there is a global saving glut. At the same time, there's less demand for these savings from the corporate sector because we're moving to a capital-light economy with less need for physical investment. This saving glut has depressed interest rates, what we call the equilibrium interest rate or the neutral or the natural rate of interest. Central banks have to react to that, you know, and so they've been adjusting their rates lower. But that then in turn, as you say, that then requires savers to save even more to achieve their wealth targets. So we're in a bit of a vicious circle here. It's really hard to see how we can get out of this without somebody stepping up who is willing to dissave, and that's, you know, could be the government, so more fiscal, higher fiscal deficits, or we'll just have to wait until all these people who are now trying to save more for retirement will finally have retired and will start to draw down those savings.
Okay, so that's
like a super secular thing. This will, I mean, the baby boomers are now approaching retirement age, but it will take at least another 10, if not 15 years, at least here in Europe, until, you know, virtually all of the baby boomers will have retired. And then it's also not clear, if you look at the empirical evidence, it's not really clear that pensioners really dissave in any massive way. Until the very...
Particularly because they have such a long... That they've got to insure themselves against living for a long time. So they...
Right.
Yeah, it sounds very simple that you want to, you know, die at the moment that you run out of pension savings. But obviously you don't really. You need to kind of overshoot with your savings.
So. Exactly. So I think this is a major reason why we think that whether we like it or not, and most of us don't like it, we will live in this low interest rate environment for a long time. So that's been part and parcel of PIMCO's new normal, new neutral theme, which, you know, we've been talking about for the last 10 years. And I'm afraid we'll talk about this for another 5 to 10 years at least.
Oh, well, tune in for the next Bruin podcast then, yeah. So I guess this all kind of circles back to trying to come up with some non-interest rate related kind of means of stimulating the economy. And so you mentioned fiscal. What do you think? We've seen some changes in Europe, in European fiscal policy over the last year or couple of years. Do you think we are going to see more fiscal stimulus, and will it be of the kind of magnitude that we need in order to stimulate demand meaningfully?
So, first of all, I do think that we'll see more fiscal over time. So fiscal policy is becoming more expansionary in many places.
Yeah.
Even in Germany, which, you know, for traditional reasons, they're still sticking to their black zero, running a budget surplus. Even in Germany, things are moving, partly in response to the heightened awareness of climate-related risks, which requires investment.
Green New Deal.
And so on. So I think that's where the trend is moving. Also, populist movements in various countries, you know, make governments more prone to fiscal expansion. So I think it's happening over time, and it will support growth over time. But again, the demographics in Europe does not look that good. Also, Europe is very strongly linked into the global trade cycle, and we have seen a structural downshift in trade growth and in emerging market growth, which is also an important source of export demand for European products. So I wouldn't get my hopes too high. So I think we'll probably see a shift in the structure of growth, in the composition of growth. So less externally led, more domestically led with the help of fiscal policy. But I don't think that we can hope for really a significant acceleration in growth over the next several years.
I mean, that last point about, say, Germany being and Europe being linked into trade and linked into emerging market trade, I guess with everything that's going on, that would amplify the need for a more stimulative fiscal policy to generate some more domestic demand. But you're not sounding bullish on that happening in the short term. So is the political impediment still there to prevent that from happening? Obviously, there's a lot of change going on in Germany at the moment.
Yeah, I think the main thing in Germany is that Germans generally believe, and I know this because I'm German myself, Germans generally believe that going into debt is a really bad thing. And I'll tell you a story here. The German word for debt is Schuld. But Schuld has a double meaning in German. It means debt, but it also means guilt. So if you go into debt, you feel guilty.
Right.
It's the same thing. You're guilty of taking on debt. So I think there's a cultural element in this, which makes it very difficult for Germans to really, you know, jump over the hurdle and agree to a massive fiscal expansion. Having said that, things are changing. We've mentioned Green New Deals, right? The Green Party in Germany is gaining in the polls, and they look likely to be an important part of the next coalition after the next government. They may even turn out to be the strongest party.
Yeah.
They are more prone to fiscal expansion. And so, you know, I'm still hopeful that over time things will change. But, you know, knowing my compatriots, I'm not 100% sure that we'll move there very quickly.
Okay. All right. Well, Yakim, thanks. Thanks very much, and thanks particularly for that unique perspective on the German views of debt. Really helpful in giving us an overview of how you see the economy at a time when, as we started off by saying, obviously things are really changing. And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed this interview, and we hope you will join us again for the next Brewin podcast.